I dare not ask you for more than one thing. I see that now. Save Erlan. Save my husband's life. She looked down at Husabi and thought about her sons. Now, as the manor lay swathed in the evening light like a dream vision that might be whirled away, as her fear for the uncertain fate of her children shook her heart, she remembered this. She had never fully thanked God for the rich fruits her toils had borne over the years. She had never fully thanked him for giving her a son 7 times. From the vault of the evening sky, from the countryside beneath her gaze, came the murmur of the mass intoned as she had heard it thousands of times before, in the voice of her father, who had explained the words to her when she was a child and stood at his knee. Then Sira Eirik sings the Prefatio when he turns toward the altar, and in Norwegian it means, "Truly it is right and just, proper and redemptive that we always and everywhere should thank thee, Holy Lord, Almighty Father, Eternal God." When she lifted her face from her hands, she saw Gauta coming up the hillside. Kristin sat quietly and waited until the boy stood before her. Then she reached out to take his hand. There was grassy meadow all around, and not a single place to hide anywhere near the rock where she sat.
"How have you carried out your father's errand, my son?" she asked him softly.
"As he asked me to, mother. I made my way to the farm without being seen. Ulf wasn't home, so I burned what father had given me in the hearth. I took it out of the wrapping."
He hesitated for a moment.
"Mother, there were 9 seals on it. My Gauta."
His mother put her hands on the boy's shoulders and looked into his face.
"Your father has had to place important matters in your hands. If you don't know what else to do, but you feel you need to speak of this to someone, then tell your mother what's troubling you. But it would please me most if you could keep silent about this altogether, son."
The fair complexion beneath the straight flaxen hair, the big eyes, the full, firm red lips. He looked so much like her father now. Gauta nodded. Then he placed his arm around his mother's shoulders. With painful sweetness, Kristin noticed that she could lean her head against the boy's frail chest. He was so tall now that as he stood there and she sat beside him, her head reached to just above his heart. It was the first time she had leaned for support against this child. Gauta said,
"Isak was home alone. I didn't show him what I was carrying, just told him I had something that needed to be burned. Then he made a big fire in the hearth before he went out and saddled his horse."
Kristin nodded. Then he released her, turned to face her, and asked in a childish voice full of fear and awe,
"Mother, do you know what they're saying? They're saying that father wants to be king."
"That sounds most unlikely, child," she replied with a smile.
"But he comes from the proper lineage, mother," said the boy,
somber and proud.
"And it seems to me that father might be better at it than most other men."
"Hush." She took his hand again.
"My Gauta, you should realize, after father has shown such trust in you, you and all the rest of us must neither think nor speak, but guard our tongues well until we learn more and can judge whether we ought to speak, and in what way. I'm going to ride to Nidaros tomorrow, and if I can talk to your father alone for a moment, I'll tell him that you have carried out his errand well."
"Take me with you, mother?"
begged the boy earnestly.
"We must not let anyone think you're anything but a thoughtless child, Gauta. You will have to try, little son, to play and be as happy as you can at home. In that way, you will serve him best."
Nokva and Björgulf walked slowly up the hill. They came over to their mother and stood there, looking so young and strained and distraught. Kristin saw that they were still children enough to turn to their mother at this anxious time, and yet they were so close to being men that they wanted to console or reassure her, if they could find some way to do so. She reached out a hand to each of the boys, but neither of them said very much. After a while, they headed back home. Kristen walked with one hand on the shoulder of each of her eldest sons.
"Why are you looking at me that way, Nokva?" she said.
But the boy blushed, turned his head away, and did not reply. He had never before thought about how his mother looked. It had been years ago that he began comparing his father to other men. His father was the most handsome of men, with the bearing most like a chieftain. His mother was the mother who had more and more children. They grew up and left the hands of women to join the life and companionship and fighting and friendship of the group of brothers. His mother had open hands through which everything they needed flowed. His mother had a remedy for almost every ill. His mother's presence at the manor was like the fire in the hearth. She created life at home the way fields around Husaby created the year's crops. Life and warmth issued from her as they did from the beasts in the cowshed and the horses in the stable. The boy had never thought to compare her to other women. Tonight he suddenly saw it. She was a proud and beautiful woman. With her broad, pale forehead beneath the linen wimple, the even gaze of her steel-gray eyes under the calm arch of her brows, with her heavy bosom and her long, slender limbs, she held her tall figure as erect as a sword. But he could not speak of this. Blushing and silent, he walked beside her, with her hand on the nape of his neck. Gauta followed along behind. Björgulf was also gripping the back of his mother's belt, and the older boy began grumbling because his brother was treading on his heels. They started shoving and pushing at each other. Their mother told them to hush and put an end to their quarreling. But her somber expression softened into a smile. They were still just children, her sons. She lay awake that night. She had Munon sleeping in her breast, and Lavrans lay between her and the wall. Kristen tried to take stock of her husband's case. She couldn't believe that it was truly dangerous. Erling Vidkunsson and the king's cousins at Suderheim had been charged with treason against their king and country. But they were still here in Norway, as secure and rich as ever, although they might not stand as high in the king's favor as before. No doubt Erland had become involved in some unlawful activities in the service of Lady Ingebjerg. Over all these years he had maintained his friendship with his high-born kinswoman. Kristen knew that 5 years back, when he visited her in Denmark, he had done her some unlawful service that had to be kept secret. Now that Erling Vidkunsson had taken up Lady Ingebjerg's cause and was trying to acquire for her control of the property she owned in Norway, it was conceivable that Erling had sent her to Erland, or that she herself had turned to the son of her father's cousin after the friendship had cooled between Erling and the king. And then Erland had handled the matter recklessly. Yet if that was true, it was hard to understand how her kinsmen at Sundbu could have been involved in this. It could only end with Erland coming to a full reconciliation with the king, if he had done nothing more than act overzealously in service of the king's mother. High treason. She had heard about the downfall of Audun Hugleiksen. It had happened during her father's youth. But they were terrifying misdeeds that Audun had been charged with. Her father said it was all a lie. The maiden Margaret Eirik's daughter had died in the arms of the Bishop of Bjørgvin, but Audun took no part in the crusade, so he could not have sold her to the heathens. Maiden Isabel was 13 years old, but Audun was more than 50 when he brought her home to be King Eirik's bride. It was shameful for a Christian to pay any heed at all to such rumors as there were about that bridal procession. Her father refused to allow the ballads about Audun to be sung at home on his manor. And yet there were unheard-of things said about Audun Hestakorn. He had supposedly sold all of King Haakon's military power to the French king and promised to sail to his aid with 1,200 warships, and for that he had received 7 barrels of gold in payment. But it had never been fully explained to the peasants of the country why Audun Hugleiksen had to die on the gallows at Nordnes. His son fled the country. People said he had taken service in the army of the French king. The granddaughters of the Allhus Knight, Kiri and Sina, had left their grandfather's execution site with his stable boy. They were to live like poor peasant wives somewhere in a mountain village in Hadingjadal. It was a good thing, after all, that she and Erland did not have daughters. No, she was not going to think about such matters. It was so unlikely that Erland's case should have a worse outcome than that of Erling Vidkunsson and the Hoftersons. Nikolaus Erlandsson of Husaby. Oh, now she too felt that Husaby was the most beautiful manor in all of Norway. She would go to Sir Bard and find out all she could. The royal treasurer had always been her friend. Judge Olav as well, in the past. But Erland had gone too far, that time when the judge decided against him in the case of his estate in town, and Olav had taken to heart the misfortune with his goddaughter's husband. They had no close kinsmen, neither she nor Erland, no matter how extensive their lineage might be. Munan Bardsson no longer had great influence. He had been charged with unlawful deeds when he was sheriff of Ringerike. He was too eager in his attempts to further the position of his many children in the world. He had 4 from his marriage and 5 outside of it. And he had apparently declined greatly since Fru Katrin had died. Inge of Ree County, Julita and her husband, Ranrid, who was married to a Swede, Erland knew little of them. They were the remaining children of Herr Bard and Fru Asshild. There had never been friendship between Erland and the Hestnes people since the death of Sir Bard Pettersson. Tormod of Rovsfold had grown senile, and his children with Fru Gunna were all dead, and his grandchildren underage. Kristen herself had no other kinsmen in Norway from her father's lineage than Ketil Osmundsson of Skog and Sigurd Schierning, who was married to her uncle's oldest daughter. The second daughter was a widow, and the third was a nun. All 4 of the men of Sundbu seemed to be involved in the case. Lavrans had become such foes with Erland Eljarn over the inheritance after Ivar Yesling's death that they had refused to see each other ever again, so Kristin did not know her aunt's husband or his son. The ailing monk at the friar's monastery was Erland's only close kinsman. And the one who stood closest to Kristin in the world was Simon Dara, since he was married to her only sister. Munan woke up and began to whimper. Kristin turned over in bed and placed the child to her other breast. She couldn't take him with her to Nidaros, as uncertain as everything now stood. Perhaps this would be the last drink the poor child would ever have from his own mother's breast. Perhaps this was the last time in this world that she would lie in bed holding a little infant. So good, so good. If Erland was condemned to death, Blessed Mary, Mother of God, if she had ever for an hour or a day been impatient because of the children that God had granted to her, was this to be the last kiss she ever received from a little mouth, sweet with milk? Chapter 5. Kristin went to the king's palace the next evening, as soon as she arrived in Nidaros. Where are they holding Erland? She wondered as she looked around at the many stone buildings. She seemed to be thinking more about how Erland might be faring than about what she needed to find out. But she was told that the royal treasurer was not in town. Her eyes were stinging from the long boat trip in the glittering sunshine, and her breasts were bursting with milk. After the servants who slept in the main house had fallen asleep, she got out of bed and paced the floor all night. The next day she sent Haldor, her personal servant, over to the king's palace. He came back shocked and distressed. His uncle, Ulf Haldorsson, had been taken prisoner on the fjord as he attempted to reach the monastery on the island of Holm. The royal treasurer had not yet returned. This news also frightened Kristin terribly. Ulf had not lived at Husaby during the past year, but had served as the sheriff's deputy, residing for the most part at Skjolvetstad, a large share of which he now owned. What kind of matter could this be when so many men seemed to be involved? She couldn't stop herself from thinking the worst, ill and exhausted as she now was. By the morning of the third day, Sir Bard had still not returned home. And a message that Kristen had tried to send to her husband was not allowed through. She thought about seeking out Gunnulf at the monastery, but decided against it. She paced the floor at home, back and forth, again and again, with her eyes half-closed and burning. Now and then she felt as if she were walking in her sleep, but as soon as she lay down, fear and pain would seize hold of her, and she would have to get up again, wide awake, and walk to make it bearable. Shortly after mid-afternoon prayers, Gunnulf Nikolausen came to see her. Kristen walked swiftly toward the monk.
Have you seen Erlan? Gunnulf, what are they accusing him of?
The news is troubling, Kristen. No, they won't allow anyone near Erlan. Least of all any of us from the monastery. They think that Abbot Olav knew about his undertakings. He borrowed money from the brothers. But they swear they knew nothing about what he intended to use it for when they placed the cloister's seal on the document. And Abbot Olav refuses to give any explanation.
Yes, but what is it all about? Was it the Duchess who lured Erlund into this?
Gunnulf replied, It seems instead that they had to press hard before she would agree. Someone has seen drafts of a letter, which Erlund and his friends sent to her in the spring. It's not likely to fall into the hands of the authorities unless they can threaten Lady Ingebjerg to part with it. And they haven't found any drafts. But according to both the reply letter and the letter from Herr Olga Laurison, which they seized from Borgar Tronson and Vir, it seems certain enough that she did receive such a missive from Erlund and the men who have joined forces with him in this plan. For a long time she clearly seemed to fear sending Prince Håkon to Norway, but they persuaded her that no matter what the outcome might be, King Magnus would not possibly harm the child, since they are brothers. Even if Håkon Knutsen did not win the crown in Norway, he would be no worse off than before. But these men were willing to risk their lives and their property to put him on the throne. For a long time, Kristen sat in utter silence.
I understand.
These are more serious matters than what came between Sir Erling or the Hoftersons and the king. Yes, said Gunnulf in a subdued voice. Haftur Olafsson and Erlund were supposedly sailing to Björgvin. But they were actually heading for Kalundborg, and they were to bring Prince Håkon back with them to Norway while King Magnus was abroad courting his bride. After a moment, the monk continued in the same tone of voice. It must be nearly 100 years since any Norwegian has dared attempt such a thing. To overthrow the man who was king by right of succession and replace him with an opposing king. Kristen sat and stared straight ahead. Gunnulf could not see her face.
Yes. The last men who dared undertake this game were your ancestors and Erlund's.
Back then, my deceased kinsmen of the Yesling lineage were also on the side of King Skule, she said pensively. She met Gunnulf's searching glance and then exclaimed hotly and fiercely, I'm merely a simple woman, Gunnulf. I paid little attention when my husband spoke with other men about such matters. I was unwilling to listen when he wanted to discuss them with me. God help me, I don't have the wits to understand such weighty topics. But foolish woman that I am, with knowledge of nothing more than my household duties and rearing children, even I know that justice had much too long a road to travel before any grievance could find its way to the king and then back again to the villages. I too have seen that the peasants of this country are faring worse and must endure more hardships now than when I was a child, and blessed King Håkon was our lord. My husband, she took several quick shuddery breaths, my husband took up a cause that was so great that none of the other chieftains in all the land dared raise it. I see that now. That he did. The monk clasped his hands tightly together. His voice was hardly more than a whisper. Such a great cause,
that many will think it very grave that he brought about its downfall himself, and in this way. Kristen cried out and leaped to her feet. She moved with such force that the pain in her breast and arms brought the sweat pouring from her body. Agitated and dizzy with fever, she turned to Gunnulf and shouted loudly,
"Erland is not to blame. It just happened. It was his misfortune."
She threw herself to her knees and pressed her hands on the bench. She lifted her blazing, desperate face to the monk.
"You and I, Gunnulf, you, his brother, and I, his wife for 13 years. We shouldn't blame Erland now that he's a poor prisoner, with his life perhaps in danger."
Gunnulf's face quivered. He looked down at the kneeling woman. "May God reward you, Kristen, for accepting things in this manner." Again he wrung his emaciated hands. "God, may God grant Erland life and such circumstances that he might repay your loyalty. May God turn this evil away from you and your children, Kristen."
"Don't talk like that."
She straightened her back as she knelt and looked up into the monk's eyes. "No good has come of it, Gunnulf, whenever you have taken on Erland's affairs or mine. No one has judged him more harshly than you, his brother and God's servant."
"Never have I judged Erland more harshly
than was necessary." His pale face had grown even paler. "I've never loved anyone on earth more than my brother. That is no doubt why they stung me as if they were my own sins, sins that I had to repent myself when Erland dealt with you so badly. And then there is Husabi. Erland alone must carry on the lineage which is also mine. And I have put most of my inheritance into his hands. Your sons are the men who are closest to me by blood."
"Erland has not dealt with me badly. I was no better than him. Why are you talking to me in this way, Gunnulf? You were never my confessor. Sirrah Eilif never blamed my husband. He admonished me for my sins whenever I complained of my difficulties to him. He was a better priest than you are. He's the one God has placed over me. He's the one I must listen to, and he has never said that I suffered unjustly. I will listen to him."
Gunnulf stood up when she did. Pale and distressed, he murmured, "What you say is true. You must listen to Sirrah Eilif." He turned to go, but she gripped his hand tightly.
"No, don't leave me like this. I remember, Gunnulf. I remember when I visited you here on this estate, back when it belonged to you. And you were kind to me. I remember the first time I met you. I was in great need and anguish. I remember you spoke to me in Erland's defense. You couldn't know. You prayed and prayed for my life and my child's. I know that you meant us well, and that you loved Erland. Oh, don't speak harshly of Erland, Gunnulf. Who among us is pure before God? My father grew fond of him, and our children love their father. Remember that he found me weak and easy to sway, but he led me to a good and honorable place. Oh, yes, Husabi is beautiful. On the night before I left, it was so lovely. The sunset was magnificent that evening. We've spent many a good day there, Erland and I. No matter how things go, no matter what happens, he is still my husband. My husband whom I love."
Gunnulf leaned both hands on his staff, which he always carried now whenever he left the monastery.
"Kristen, do not put your faith in the red of the sunset and in the love that you remember, now that you fear for his life.
I remember when I was young, only a subdeacon. Gudbjörg, whom Alf of Uvason later married, was serving at Seaheim then. She was accused of stealing a gold ring. It turned out that she was innocent, but the shame and the fear shook her soul so fiercely that the fiend seized power over her. She went down to the lake and was about to sink into the water. She has often told us of this afterwards, that the world seemed to her such a lovely red and gold, and the water glistened and felt wondrously warm. But as she stood out there in the lake, she spoke the name of Jesus and made the sign of the cross.
And then the whole world grew gray and cold, and she saw where she was headed.
Then I won't say his name.
Kristen spoke quietly. Her bearing was rigid and erect.
If I thought that,
then I would be tempted to betray my Lord when he is in need. But I don't think it would be the name of Christ, but rather the name of the devil that would bring this about. That's not what I meant. I meant, may God give you strength, Kristen, that you may have the will to do this, to bear your husband's faults with a loving spirit.
You can see that's what I'm doing, she said in the same voice as before.
Gunnulf turned away from her, pale and trembling. He drew his hand over his face. I must go home now. It's easier. At home, it's easier for me to collect myself, to do what I can for Erland and for you. God, may God and all the saints protect my brother's life and freedom. Oh, Kristen, you mustn't ever think that I don't love my brother. But after he had left, Kristen thought everything seemed much worse. She didn't want the servants in the room with her. She paced back and forth, wringing her hands and moaning softly. It was already late in the evening when people came riding into the courtyard. A moment later, as the door was thrown open, a tall, stout man wearing a traveling cloak appeared in the twilight. He walked toward her with his spurs ringing and his sword trailing behind. When she recognized Simon Anderson, Kristen broke into loud sobbing and ran toward him with outstretched arms, but she shrieked in pain when he embraced her. Simon let her go. She was standing with her hands on his shoulders and her forehead leaning against his chest, weeping inconsolably. He put his hands lightly on her hips. In God's name, Kristen. There was a sense of deliverance in the very sound of his dry, warm voice and in the vital male smell about him, of sweat, road dust, horses, and leather harness work. In God's name, it's much too soon to lose all hope and courage. Surely there must be a way. After a while, she regained her composure enough to ask his forgiveness. She was feeling quite wretched because she had been forced to take the youngest child from her breast so suddenly. Simon heard how she had been faring the last 3 days. He shouted for her maid and asked angrily whether there wasn't a single woman on the estate who had enough wits to see what was wrong with the mistress. But the maid was an inexperienced young girl, and Erland's foreman of his Nidaros manor was a widower with 2 unmarried daughters. Simon sent a man to town to find a woman skilled in healing, but he begged Kristen to lie down and rest. When she felt a little better, he would come in and talk to her. While they waited for the woman to arrive, Simon and his man were given food in the hall. As they ate, he talked to Kristen, who was undressing in the alcove. Yes, he had ridden north as soon as he heard what had happened at Sunbu. He had come here while Romborg went to stay with the wives of Ivar and Borgar. They had taken Ivar to Muir's castle, but they allowed Havard to remain free, although he had to promise to stay in the village. It was said that Borgar and Guttorm had been fortunate enough to flee. Jon of Laugarbru had ridden out to Raumsdal to hear the news and would send word to Nidaros. Simon had reached Husaby around midday, but he hadn't stayed long. The boys were fine, but Nokva and Björgulf had begged him earnestly to bring them along. Kristen had regained her calm and courage when Simon, late that evening, came to sit at her bedside. She lay there with a feeling of pleasant exhaustion which follows great suffering, and looked at her brother-in-law's heavy, sunburned face and his small, piercing eyes. It was a great comfort to her that he had come. Simon grew quite somber when he heard more details of the matter, and yet his words were full of hope. Kristen lay in bed, staring at the elkskin belt around his portly middle. The large, flat buckle made of copper and chased with silver, its only decoration a filigreed A and M, which stood for Ave Maria. The long dagger with the gilded silver mountings and the large rock crystals on the hilt. The pitiful little table knife with its cracked horn hilt, which had been repaired with a band of brass. All these things had been part of her father's everyday attire ever since she was a child. She remembered when Simon received them. It was right before her father died, and he wanted to give Simon his best gilded belt with enough silver to have extra plates made so that his son-in-law could wear it. But Simon asked for the other belt instead, and when Lavron said that now he was cheating himself, Simon replied that the dagger was a costly item.
Yes.
And then there's the knife, said Ronfrid with a little smile, and both men laughed and said, yes indeed, the knife. Her father and mother had had so many quarrels over that knife. Ronfrid had complained every day at having to look at that ugly little knife on her husband's belt. But Lavron swore that she would never succeed in parting him from it. I've never drawn this knife against you, Ronfrid. And it's the best one in all of Norway for cutting butter, as long as it's warm. Kristen now asked to see the knife, and she lay in bed, holding it in her hands for a moment. I wish that I might own this knife, she pleaded softly.
Yes, I can well believe that. I'm glad it's mine. I wouldn't sell it for even 20 marks of silver.
With a laugh, Simon grabbed her wrist and took back the knife. His small, plump hands always felt so good, warm and dry. A short time later, he bade her goodnight, picked up the candle, and went into the main room. She heard him kneel down before the cross, then stand up and drop his boots onto the floor. A few minutes later, he climbed heavily into the bed against the north wall. Then Kristen sank into a deep, sweet sleep. She didn't wake up until quite late the next morning. Simon Andresen had left hours earlier, and he had asked the servants to tell her to stay calm and remain at the estate. He didn't return until almost time for mid-afternoon prayers. He said at once, I bring you greetings from Erland, Kristen. I was allowed to speak to him. He saw how young her face became, soft and full of anguished tenderness. Then he held her hand in his as he talked. He and Erland hadn't been able to say much to each other because the man who had escorted Simon up to the prisoner never left the room. Judge Olav had won Simon permission for this meeting because of the kinship that had existed between them while Hofrid was alive. Erland sent loving greetings to Kristen and the children. He had asked about all of them, but most about Gauta. Simon thought that in a few days Kristen would surely be allowed to see her husband. Erland had seemed calm and in good spirits. If I had gone with you today, they would have let me see him too, she said quietly. But Simon thought he had been granted permission because he came alone, although it might be easier for you in many ways, Kristen, to gain concessions if a man steps forward in your behalf. Erland was being held in a room in the East Tower, facing the river, one of the finer chambers, although it was small. Ulf Haldorsson was supposedly sitting in the dungeon, Hoftor in a different chamber. Cautiously and hesitantly, as he tried to discern how much she could bear, Simon recounted what he had been able to learn in town. When he saw that she understood fully what had happened, he didn't hide that he too thought it a dangerous matter. But everyone he had spoken to said that Erland would never have ventured to plan such an undertaking and carry it out as far as he had without being certain that he had a majority of the knights and gentry behind him. And since the ranks of the malcontent noblemen were so great, it wasn't expected that the king would dare deal harshly with their chieftain. He would have to allow Erland to be reconciled with him in some way. Kristen asked in a low voice, Where does Erling Vidkunsson stand in all this? I think that's something that many a man would like to know, said Simon. He didn't tell Kristen, nor had he told any of the men he talked to. But he thought it unlikely that Erland would have a large group of men behind him who had bound themselves to support him with their lives and property in such a perilous undertaking. And certainly they would never have chosen him as chieftain. All his peers knew that Erland was unreliable. It was true that he was the kinsman of Lady Ingebjörg and the pretender to the throne. He had enjoyed both power and respect in the last few years. He was more experienced in war than most of his peers, and he had a reputation for being able to recruit and lead soldiers. Even though he had acted unwisely so many times, he could still present his arguments in such a good and convincing manner that it was almost possible to believe he had finally learned caution from his misdeeds. Simon thought it likely that there were some who knew of Erlan's plan and had urged him on, but he would be surprised if they had bound themselves so closely that they couldn't now retreat. Erlan would be left standing with no one to back him. Simon thought he could see that Erlan himself expected little else, and he seemed prepared to have to pay dearly for his risky game. "When cows are stuck in the mire, whoever owns them has to pull them out by the tail," he had said with a laugh. Otherwise, Erlund had not been able to say much in the presence of the third man. Simon wondered why the reunion with his brother-in-law had upset him so greatly. Perhaps it was the small, confining tower room where Erlund had invited him to take a seat on the bed, which stretched from one wall to the other and filled half the room. Or Erlund's slender, dignified form as he stood at the small slit in the wall which allowed in light. Erlund looked unafraid, his eyes alert, unclouded by either fear or hope. He was a vigorous, cool, and manly figure now that all the constraining webs of flirtations and foolishness over women had been swept away from him. And yet it was women and his dealings in love that had landed him there, along with all his bold plans, which came to an end before he had even brought them to light. But Erlan didn't seem to be thinking about that. He stood there like a man who had risked the most daring adventures and lost, and then knew how to bear the defeat in a manly and stalwart fashion. And his surprised and joyous gratitude when he saw his brother-in-law suited him well. Simon had said, "Do you remember, brother-in-law? That night we kept watch at our father-in-law's bedside. We shook hands, and Lavrans placed his hand on top. We promised each other and him that all our days we would stand together as brothers." "Yes." Erlan's smile lit up his face. "Yes, Lavrans probably never thought that you would ever be in need of my help." "It was more likely," said Simon unperturbed, "that he meant you, in your circumstances, might be of support to me, and not that you should need my help." Erlan smiled again. "Lavrans was a wise man, Simon. And as strange as it may sound, I know he was fond of me." Simon thought that God knew it might indeed seem strange, but now he himself, in spite of all he knew about Erlan, and in spite of everything the other man had done to him, couldn't help feeling a brotherly tenderness toward Kristen's husband. Then Erlan had asked about her. Simon told him how he had found her, ill and very frightened for her husband. Olav Hermansen had promised to seek permission for her to come to see him as soon as Sir Bard returned home. "Not before she's well," said Erlan quickly, his voice fearful. An odd, almost girlish blush spread across his tan, unshaven face. "That's the only thing I fear, Simon. That I won't be able to bear it when I see her." But after a moment he said calmly, "I know you will stand steadfast at her side if she is to be widowed this year. They won't be poor, at any rate, she and the children, with her inheritance from Lavrans. And then she'll have you close at hand when she goes to live at Urengard." The day after the feast of the birth of Mary, the Lord Chancellor, Ivar Ogmundsson, arrived in Nidaros. A court was now appointed, consisting of 12 of the king's retainers from the northern districts, to decide Erlan Nikolausen's case. Sir Finn Ogmundsson, the Lord Chancellor's brother, was chosen to present the charges against him. In the meantime, during the summer, Haftor Olafsson of Godur had killed himself, using the little dagger that every prisoner was allowed to keep to cut up his food. Imprisonment had apparently taken such a toll on Haftor that he hadn't had his full wits about him. When Erland heard of this, he told Simon that at least now he wouldn't have to worry about what Haftor might say. And yet he was clearly shaken. Gradually, it became a habit for the guard to leave the room on an errand whenever Simon or Kristen was visiting Erlan. Both of them realized, and mentioned it to each other, that Erlan's first and foremost thought was to make it through the court case without revealing his accomplices. One day he said this quite openly to Simon. He had promised every man who had conspired with him that he would rather cut off his own hand than reveal anything, if it came to that. "And I have never yet betrayed anyone who has put their trust in me." Simon stared at the man. Erlan's eyes were blue and clear. It was obvious that he truly believed this about himself. The king's envoys had not succeeded in tracking down anyone else who had taken part in Erlan's plot other than the two brothers, Greip and Torvard Torreson of Mura, and they refused to admit to knowing anything but that Erland and several other men planned to persuade Lady Ingebjerg to allow Prince Håkon Knutsen to be educated in Norway. Later, the chieftains would propose to King Magnus that it would be of benefit to both of his kingdoms if he gave his half-brother sovereignty in Norway. Borgar and Guttorm Trondsen had been fortunate enough to escape from the king's castle at Vir. No one knew how, but people guessed that Borgar had been helped by a woman. He was very handsome and quite impetuous. Ivar of Sundbu was still being held at Myrs Castle. The brothers had apparently kept young Havard out of their plans. At the same time, the meeting of the retainers was being held at the king's palace. The archbishop convened a concilium at his estate. Simon was a man with many friends and acquaintances, and so he could report to Kristen what was happening. Everyone thought that Erland would be banished and would have to forfeit his properties to the king. Erland also thought this was how things would turn out, and he was in good spirits. He was planning to go to Denmark. As things now stood in that country, there were always opportunities open for a man who was fit and skilled with weapons, and Lady Ingebjerg would surely embrace his wife as her kinswoman and keep her at her side with the proper honors. Simon would have to take care of the children, although Erland wanted to take his two eldest sons with him. Kristen hadn't been outside of Nidaros for a single day in all this time, nor had she seen her children, except for Nokve and Bjørgulf. They had come riding up to the estate one evening alone. Their mother kept them with her for several days, but then she sent them to Roswald, where Fru Gunna had taken in the younger boys. This was in accordance with Erland's wishes, and she was afraid of the thoughts that might rise up in her mind if she should see her sons around her, hear their questions, and try to explain matters to them. She struggled to push aside all thoughts and memories of her marriage years spent at Husaby, which had been so rich that now they seemed to her like a great calm, the way there is a kind of calm over the waves of the sea if viewed from high enough up a mountain ridge. The swells that surge after each other seem eternal, melding into one. That was the way life had rippled through her soul during that vast span of years. Now things were once again the way they had been in her youth, when she had put her faith in Erlan, defying everyone and everything. Once again her life had become one long waiting from hour to hour, in between the times when she was allowed to see her husband, to sit at his side on the bed in the tower room of the king's palace, and to talk with him calmly, until they happened to be alone for a few minutes. Then they would throw themselves into each other's arms with endless passionate kisses and wild embraces. At other times, she would sit in Christchurch for hours on end. She would sink to her knees and stare up at St. Olav's golden shrine behind the gratings of the choir. "Lord, I am his wife. Lord, I stood by him when I was his, in sin and iniquity. By the grace of God, we two unworthy souls were joined together in holy marriage. Branded by the flames of sin, bowed by the burdens of sin, we came together at the portals of God's house. Together we received the Savior's host from the hand of the priest. Should I now complain if God is testing my faith? Should I now think about anything else but that I am his wife and he is my husband for as long as we both shall live?" On the Thursday before Michaelmas, The meeting of the royal retainers was held, and sentence was pronounced over Erlan Nikolausen of Husaby. He was found guilty of attempting to steal land and subjects from King Magnus, of inciting opposition to the king throughout the country, and of attempting to bring into Norway mercenary forces from abroad. After looking into similar cases from the past, the judges found that Erlan Nikolausen should forfeit his life and his property at the hands of King Magnus. Arne Javoldsen brought the news to Simon Dare and Kristin Lavransdatter at Nikolausgard. He had been present at the meeting. Erland had not tried to prove his innocence. In a clear, firm voice, he had acknowledged his intentions. With these undertakings, he had sought to force King Magnus Eiriksson to grant the crown of Norway to his young half-brother, Prince Håkon Knutsen Porsche. Erland had spoken eloquently, thought Arne. He had talked about the great hardships that had befallen his countrymen, because for the past few years the king had spent little time within Norway's boundaries, and had never seemed willing to appoint representatives who could rule justly and exercise royal authority. Because of the king's actions in Skåne, and because of the extravagance and inability to handle money matters shown by those men he listened to most, the people had been subjected to great burdens and poverty, and they never felt safe from new demands for aid and taxes above what was normally expected. Since the Norwegian knights and noblemen had far fewer rights and freedom than the Swedish knighthood, it was difficult for the former to compete with the latter. And it was only reasonable that the young and imprudent man, King Magnus Eiriksson, should listen more to his Swedish lords and love them better, since they had more wealth and thus a greater ability to support him with men who were both armed and experienced in war. Erland and his allies had thought they could sense such strong feelings among the majority of their countrymen, the gentry, farmers, and townsmen in the north and west of Norway, that they were certain of finding full support if they could produce a royal rival who was as closely related to our dear lord, the blessed King Håkon, as the king who was now in power. Erland had expected that his countrymen would rally around the plan to persuade King Magnus to allow his brother to assume the throne here, but Prince Håkon would have to swear to maintain peace and brotherhood with King Magnus, to protect the kingdom of Norway in accordance with the ancient land boundaries, to assert the rights of God's church, to enforce the laws and customs of the land according to ancient tradition, along with the rights and freedoms of the peasants and townsmen, as well as to fend off any incursion of foreigners into the realm. It had been the intention of Erland and his friends to present this plan to King Magnus in a peaceful manner. And yet, it had always been the right of Norwegian farmers and chieftains in the past to reject any king who attempted to rule unlawfully. As to the actions of Ulf Saxason in England and Scotland, Erland said that Ulf's sole purpose had been to win favor there for Prince Håkon, if God should grant that he became king. No other Norwegian man had taken part in these endeavors except for Halvdor Olavsson of Goder. May God have mercy on his soul. The three sons of his kinsmen Trond Gjesling of Sundbu, and Gripe and Torvard Torreson of the Hatteberg lineage. Erland's speech had made a deep impression, said Arne Javoldsen. But in the end, when he mentioned that they had expected support from men of the church, he then referred to the old rumors from the days when King Magnus was growing up, and that had been unwise, thought Arne. The archbishop's representative had responded sharply. Archbishop Paul Bardsson, both now and when he was chancellor, felt great love for King Magnus because of his godly temperament, and people wanted to forget that these rumors had ever existed about their king. Now he was about to marry a maiden, the daughter of the Earl of Namur. So even if there had ever been any truth to the rumors, Magnus Eiriksson had now completely turned away from such interests. Arne Javoldsen had shown Simon Andresen the greatest friendship while he was in Nidaros. It was also Arne who now reminded Simon that Erland had the right to appeal this sentence as having been unlawfully decided. According to the law books, the charge against Erland had to be brought by one of his peers, but Sir Finn of Hestburg was a knight,
while Erland was a nobleman, but not a knight. Arne thought it was possible that a new court would find that Erland could not be sentenced to a harsher punishment than banishment. In terms of what Erland had proposed, about the kind of sovereignty which he thought would serve the country best, that had sounded fine indeed. And everyone knew where the man was who would like to take the helm and steer that course while the new king was underage. Arne scratched the gray stubble of his beard and gave Simon a sidelong glance.
"No one has heard from Erling Vidkunsson, or spoken to him all summer?" asked Simon, also keeping his voice low.
"No.
Well, I've heard he says he's fallen out of favor with the king, and is keeping out of all such matters. But it's been years since he could stand to sit at home for such a long time and listen to Fru Aelin chattering. People say his daughters are just as beautiful and just as foolish as their mother."
Erland had listened to his sentence with a steadfast, calm expression, and he had greeted the gentlemen of the royal retinue in just as courteous, open, and splendid a manner when he was led out as when he had been escorted in. He was calm and cheerful when Kristen and Simon were allowed to talk to him the following day. Arne Javaldsen was with them, and Erland said that he would take Arne's advice.
"I could never persuade Kristen here to come with me to Denmark before," he said, putting an arm around his wife's waist. "And I always had such a desire to journey out into the world with her."
A tremor seemed to pass over his features, and suddenly he pressed an ardent kiss to her pale cheek, without concern for the two men who stood looking on. Simon Andersen set off for Husaby to make arrangements for Kristen's personal possessions to be moved to Jørundgard. He had also advised her to send the children to Gudbrandsdal at the same time. Kristen said,
"My sons will not leave their father's estate until they are driven from it."
"I wouldn't wait for that, if I were you," said Simon. "They're young. They can't fully understand these things. It would be better if you let them leave Husaby believing that they are merely going to visit their aunt and see their mother's property in the valley."
Erland said that Simon was right about this.
But in the end, only Ivar and Skúla traveled with their uncle south. Kristen didn't have the heart to send the two youngest boys so far away from her. When Lavrans and Munan were brought to her at the estate in town, and she saw that the smallest didn't even recognize her, she broke down. Simon hadn't seen her shed a single tear since the first evening he arrived in Nidaros. Now she wept and wept over Munan, who squirmed and wriggled in the crush of his mother's arms, wanting to go to his foster mother. And she wept over little Lavrans, who crept up into his mother's lap and put his arms around her neck and cried because she was crying. Now she would keep the two youngest with her, along with Gauta, who didn't want to go with Simon. She also thought it ill-advised to let the child out of her sight, since he had to bear a burden that was much too heavy for his age. Sira Eilev had brought the children to Nidaros. He had asked the archbishop for leave from his church and permission to visit his brother in Tautra. This was gladly granted to Erland Nikolausen's house priest. Now he said that Kristen couldn't stay in town with so many children to care for, and he offered to take Nokva and Bjørgulf out to the monastery. On the last evening before the priest and the two boys were to depart, Simon had already left with the twins. Kristen made her confession to the pious and pure-hearted man who had been her spiritual father all these years. They sat together for hours, and Sira Eilev impressed upon her heart that she must be humble and obedient toward God, patient, faithful, and loving toward her husband. She knelt before the bench where he sat. Then Sira Eilev stood up and knelt at her side, still wearing the red stole which was a symbol of the yoke of Christ's love. He prayed long and fervently without words. But she knew he was praying for the father and mother and the children and all the servants whose salvation he had striven so faithfully to encourage all these years. The next day Kristen stood on the shore of Brotter and watched the lay brothers from Tautra set sail in the boat that would carry away the priest and her two eldest sons.
On her way home, she went over to the Minorites' church and stayed there until she felt strong enough to venture back to her own residence. And in the evening, when the two youngest were asleep, she sat with her spinning and told Gauta stories until it was his bedtime too. Chapter 6 Erlund was held at the king's palace until almost St. Clement's Day. Then messages and letters arrived stating that he was to be taken under safe conduct to meet with King Magnus. The king intended to celebrate Christmas at Bogahus that year. Kristin grew terribly frightened. With unspeakable effort, she had accustomed herself to feigning a calm demeanor while Erlund sat in prison, condemned to death. Now he would be taken far away to an uncertain fate. Much was said about the king, and among the circle of men who stood closest to him, her husband had no friends. Ivar Ogmundsson, who was now the chieftain of the castle at Bogahus, had spoken the harshest words regarding Erlund's treason. And he was supposedly further enraged at having heard once again some disrespectful remarks which Erlund had made about him. But Erlund was in good spirits. Kristin could see that he didn't take their imminent separation lightly. But the long imprisonment had now begun to wear him down. He eagerly seized upon the prospect of a long sea voyage and seemed almost indifferent to everything else. In a matter of 3 days, everything was arranged, and Erlund sailed with Sir Finn's ship. Simon had promised to return to Nidaros before Advent, after he had taken care of some obligations at home. If there was any news before then, he had asked Kristin to send word to him, and he would come at once. Now she decided to travel south to visit him, and from there she would go to see the king, to fall at his feet and beg for mercy for her husband. She would gladly give all she possessed in return for his life. Erlund had sold and mortgaged every part of his residence in Nidaros to various buyers. Nidarholm Cloister now owned the main house, but Abbot Olav had written a kind letter to Kristin, offering her the use of the house for as long as she needed it. She was living there alone with one maid and Ulf Haldorsson, who had been released because they hadn't been able to prove anything against him, and his nephew Haldor, who was Kristin's personal servant. She sought Ulf's counsel, and at first he was rather doubtful. He thought it would be a difficult journey for her through the Dovre Range. A great deal of snow had fallen in the mountains. But when he saw the anguish of her soul, he advised her to go. Fru Gunna took the two youngest children out to Rosvold, but Gauta refused to be parted from his mother, and she didn't dare let the boy out of her sight up there in the north. The weather was so severe when they came south to the Dovre Range that they followed Ulf's advice to leave their horses behind at Drivstuen and borrowed skis, prepared to spend the next night out in the open if need be. Kristin hadn't had skis on her feet since she was a child, so it was difficult for her to make progress, even though the men supported her as best they could. They reached no farther that day than halfway over the mountain, between Drivstuen and Yershin. When it began to grow dark, they had to seek shelter in a birch grove and dig themselves into the snow. At Toftar, they managed to hire some horses, but there they ran into fog, and when they had descended partway into the valley, rain set in. When they rode into the courtyard of Formo several hours after dark, the wind was howling around the corners of the building, the river was roaring, and a great rushing and droning came from the forested slopes. The courtyard was a soggy mire, muffling the sound of the horses' hooves. As the Sabbath had already begun at this hour on Saturday evening, there was no sign of life on the large estate, and neither the servants nor the dogs seemed to have noticed their arrival. Ulf pounded on the door to the main house with his spear. A serving man opened the door. A moment later, Simon himself was standing in the entryway, broad and dark against the light behind him, holding a child in his arms. He pushed back the barking dogs. He gave a shout when he recognized his wife's sister, set the child down, and then pulled Kristin and Gauta inside as he helped them out of their soaked outer garments. It was splendidly warm in the room, but the air seemed oppressive because it was a hearth room with a flat ceiling beneath the loft hall. And it was full of people. Children and dogs were swarming from every corner. Then Kristen caught sight of both of her own small sons, their faces ruddy and warm and gleeful, behind the table on which a lighted candle stood. The two boys came forward and greeted their mother and brother a bit awkwardly. Kristen